Furlong Reel 3.
Well, of course, the Caudron burnt castor oil, neat castor oil. The reason for this was, of course, it didn't mix with the petrol. And this had somewhat disastrous effects on the pupils, particularly one who used to run behind breathing it and shouting, wonderful, wonderful.
What disastrous effects did it have on the pupils exactly? Do you used to cough back in your face or something?
No, no. You need to go to the lavatory pretty frequently.
Were all of the Caudrons that were in use with the Hall School exactly the same?
No, there was a slightly bigger one. The normal one we learnt on was a three-cylinder, 35 horsepower, with an Anzani engine, 35 horse Anzani engine. Then there was a slightly bigger one with a 45 six-cylinder Anzani engine. And there was a third one, was a bit of a hybrid, which Hall himself had made by using the front end of a Caudron with a 45 engine and dispensing with the booms and putting in what amounted to a fuselage, as we now know it, and a tail wheel. It was supposed to be a bit faster. I can't recall whether it really was or not.
Did you fly in the modified one?
No, I didn't. I had my photo taken in that. This was the honour we were allowed when we had our photograph taken to put on our licence. Otherwise, only Mr. Hall flew this particular one. Incidentally, I remember an incident about this. Hall was flying this one day, and he was about 20 feet up, and the engine fell out. And he landed without any damage. The engine just flopped out, and the thing sort of sagged and sat down with a plop. How it did it, I don't know. But
so the airplane became a glider, in effect?
Well, no, because the balance was out, you see. All the weight which should have been in front had gone. Why it didn't drop tail first, slap on the ground, I can't imagine. I suppose at 20 feet it didn't have time to do it. It should have crashed tail first.
Now, going back to the development of your own flying training, you explained you started off doing straights on the airfield, learning to control the aircraft on the ground. What was the next stage in the process?
Well, on this straight business, you held the stick more or less central. You could just get the feel of it to and fro a little bit, but you held it more or less stationary. You could get the side balance a little bit, and you controlled your height simply on the switch. Well, now, and you could controlled your height, as I say, on the switch by keeping the engine on longer or shorter periods. And as you got used to flying across at 5 or 6 feet high, you gradually kept the engine on a bit longer and pulled the stick back a little further, and you got up higher until you were doing perhaps 50 feet in the middle, up and down again, straight across the airfield, turn around, straight back, up and down again. And when you got that comfortably wrapped up, those you felt happy about it, then you were told to do a turn. And the process of a turn was, instead of facing the white patch on the fence, you were turned off it at about 45 degrees, and you did the first half of a straight, and when you got to the top, you levelled out and then kicked on rudder when the thing skidded round the corner. And as you kicked on rudder across, you spoilt the aerodynamic state of the aeroplane, and it dropped its nose. You didn't have to put the nose down. And there was a landing in front of you. So you had, in fact, done virtually a right-angle turn. And you kept doing this to and fro, left-hand turn one way and right-hand coming back, until you got that wrapped up.
This is still on the ground, or are you actually...
Oh, no, no, you're in the air. Oh, yes, you're up to perhaps 50, 100 feet in the middle. You climb up, and then do your so-called turn and flop round the corner, and down you went and landed. Then you turn round on the ground and come back in the reverse setup. When you'd done that to the satisfaction of the instructor, you were then allowed to struggle around the circuit.
This technique of sort of skidding around your turns, that was necessitated by the fact that you had fixed wings and no ailerons?
No, this was simply lack of knowledge of aerodynamics on the part of the instructor. I mean, now it's absolutely suicidal to do such a thing, but they didn't know any better. That was the trouble in those days. I suppose the leading pilots knew about this instinctively, but we were told that it was unsafe to get off the level, whereas obviously the correct thing would have been to have put on a bit of bank. But oh no, we were told to keep absolutely flat, which of course promptly makes the thing less efficient. But there it was. We managed to get away with it. And so we were lucky, but it was absolutely wrong.
How did you take to this? I mean, do you remember, for example, what happened the first time you tried to do it?
Well, it's a bit of a shock because you sort of fell around the corner, you see. As the rudder came on, it felt like putting a brake on, and the aeroplane's nose dropped and slewed to the left, or whichever way you were going. And then when you took the rudder off, it straightened up, and it picked up level flying.
Mm-hmm.
That's all there was to it. Mm-hmm. That was so-called a turn.
Yeah. And you developed these turns so that in due course you were flying complete circuits of the aircraft.
Well, yes, you went up and you did that. You realised that you didn't kick full rudder on. You put on a bit of rudder and it slewed and slewed and slewed. Of course, you've got a much bigger area to go round. And you sort of flew around the outside of the airfield, and when you came back to where you started, you shut off and landed.
Mm.
And that was the circuit. But again, all that time, we never did any banking. There was no banking in our school. I don't know that I remember what the other schools did, but we didn't. We weren't allowed to bank in our school.
Were there any particular events that occurred to you during this?
Well, I think... It was probably on after my first turn, I was so thrilled that I'd come down in one piece that I didn't shut off the engine sufficiently or quickly enough, and I ran straight for the pylon and everybody flew. I managed to slew a little bit and I just caught the pylon at wingtip. Didn't do any damage, but I got bawled out well and truly by the instructor and told I should be grounded forever if I did it again. But that was, that was just talk. I'll just tell you, we went for a certificate, you see, which was, I forgot what, so many figures of eight, and a landing with the engine off. Yes, that's right. Now, that finished our training. Well, it got round that the moment you'd done that and they could sign it, you were virtually thrown out, you see. So and the instructor knew this. So he used to send you up about 10 minutes before it was dark. So that you, of course, the trick was to go on flying till you ran out of petrol. See, to get a long flight in the last time. That was the drill. But this this is what happened. We all took as long as we could. Went on and on and on, because they couldn't do anything to you once you'd come down. You were out anyway, so that was the end of it, you see. They signed up your form, and you sent it to the aero club, and you got your certificate.
Now, having got your ticket at the Hull School of Flying, this brought you up to the period of about autumn 1915, when the war had been on for approximately a year, and you were beginning to consider doing your bit, as it were. What steps did you take to get into any of the services?
Well, of course, the object of learning to fly was to get into the Royal Flying Corps. So at the first opportunity, I sought an interview with the Royal Flying Corps people, and a friend introduced me to somebody at the War Office, a major somebody or other, and I went up to see him, and he passed me on to the Royal Flying Corps, presumably interviewing officer, and he had a chat and
What took place at the interview? Can you remember?
Well, I suppose he asked me, I can't remember, he asked me why I wanted to go in, and I said I'd already learned to fly, and he said, well, unfortunately you're too heavy for our aircraft, which I thought was rather peculiar.
What was the limit, do you remember?
Yes, it was 10 stone 11, I think, at the time, and I was a bit more than that, half a stone more than that. Anyway, it was made clear that it was no good me applying further because they wouldn't accept me.
That's curious, really, because there couldn't have been that many qualified pilots around.
No, well, it was one of these stupid things that this man who interviewed me probably never seen an aeroplane in his life. He was just given a set of instructions, and that was it. It was a stupid thing. It's something on the lines of army lorries are Mark 3 tons, but it's a 30 hundredweight, but in real life they are used for 5 tons. The same sort of thing. It was simply regulations which they'd got stuck with.
Having failed to get into the Royal Flying Corps, did you consider waiting and making a second application?
Well, I did, but I was induced. There was a pressure on, of course, for everybody to get into the forces, and there was a pressure put on me to go into the infantry, as I'd had officer training corps experience at school. I applied and was promptly accepted as a very junior officer and put into the Royal English Killing Fusiliers.
Now, it was some time after this before you actually made your second application to the Royal Flying Corps. In fact, it was probably as much as a year and a half, during which time you'd been to Salonika and got dysentery there, been hospitalised in England, and then been sent to France, where again you got yourself involved in an accident and went through a second period of hospital treatment and convalescence. What were the factors which influenced you to make a second application to the Royal Flying Corps, and exactly what happened when you did?
Well, in fact, the moment I got into the infantry, as soon as I plucked up courage, knew enough about it, I sought an interview with the adjutant and told him what I wanted, and he said, well, I don't think the colonel will look very kindly on this. Anyway, eventually, after some month or two, I did get into the colonel, and he was very horrified that any one of his officers should want to leave his wonderful regiment to go into a harebrained outfit like the Flying Corps, and he promptly turned it down or put me off. Anyway, I wouldn't be put off, and later I applied again, a month or so later, and it was grudgingly accepted. And then I heard no more about it, and of course, in the meantime, I'd gone overseas, lost touch with it. When I came back, I sort of sought information about my application, and finally I put in another application, again, very much against the colonel's wishes. He thought it was a great insult to the regiment. Anyway, he finally said, well, if I was that sort of an officer who didn't realise the honour of being in his lot, I could go. So it was pushed through. And it came through while I was on leave.
Now, by the time your application to the Royal Flying Corps was accepted, this would be about the middle of 1917, you were posted to Flying Training Station after a short period of ground training at Reading. And at the flying station at Harlaxton in Lincolnshire, you were given a service training in flying. What struck you about the differences in the training you received at the Hall School back in 14 and 15 as compared with the sort of service training you got now?
Well, of course, the Hall School of Training was all solo training in solo machines. As soon as I got to Harlaxton, we were on a new system altogether, which was dual training with an instructor in the other seat. And we were talked to, of course, in the air and shown how to do it. And this was a different matter. Now, I hadn't been long. In fact, on my first flight, the instructor said, oh, you know something about this. So I said, yes, as a matter of fact, I had learned to fly.
Hadn't you told them this?
No.
Why not?
Well, I didn't want it to prejudice anything. I thought if I keep quiet about this, I might learn more, you see, by not mentioning anything, just go through. But he spotted the fact that I knew something about it, so he said, all right, well, you fly it. He didn't like the way I went round corners, because I'd learnt to turn flat corners, whereas the Air Force, and in fact I suppose most other training, by then had advanced to proper bank corners. So I learned how to bank the machine, and this led to a most extraordinary accident on the second or third flight.
What happened?
Well, the instructor had, as soon as he realised I was doing flat turns, he sort of wrenched the controls out of my hand and threw it into a bank and said, "This is what I want. Do it like this, you see." So I did this, and that was all right. And we got to the next corner, he wrenched it out of my hand again, showed me how to go round. And on the last corner, he didn't sort of give it back to me, and I just sat there and watched, and we were gliding in. And we went straight in, slap into the ground, wallop. Smashed the machine to smithers. And he said, "What did you do that for?" And I said, "Well, I didn't touch it." He said, "Neither did I." He thought I'd got it, and I hadn't. I suppose this was where they altered the training, where you now have to say, "It's all yours." And they didn't do it in that time. Anyway, that was my first landing, my first exciting landing anyway, in that type machine, which was a Morris Farman Longhorn.
What struck you as the main differences in flying these Farmans as compared with the Codrons, which you'd learned to fly on at the horse school?
There wasn't a lot of difference, except that it was a better flying machine. It flew more easily. In other words, it had got a lot more power in reserve, and it floated further. In fact, it was quite a delightful machine to fly. The other one sort of hung in the air, the Codron hung in the air by the grace of God, whereas this thing felt as though it had got plenty of engine.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there was a lot of difference, really, in the actual flying.
These Farmans you were flying, or Rumpeties as they were popularly known, were regarded as being a bit laden down with wires, weren't they?
Well, they were all struts and wires. There seemed to be...